This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. If you love listening to this show as much as I love hosting it, I think you'll really like the Medal of Honor podcast, produced in partnership with the Medal of Honor Museum. Each episode talks about a genuine American hero and the actions that led to their receiving our nation's highest award for valor. They're just a few minutes each, so if you're looking for a show to fill time between these Warriors episodes, I think you'll love the Medal of Honor podcast. Search for the Medal of Honor podcast wherever you get your shows. Thanks. I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, in a special Veterans Day episode, we'll hear from Army Specialist Rocky Blyer. Blyer served in the infantry in Vietnam until an enemy grenade injured both his legs and sent him home. He made a full recovery and went on to win 4 Super Bowls with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
So, my name is Robert Patrick Rocky Blyer. I was 11 Bravo, Spec 4 when I got back, and served in Vietnam from May 1969 to August of 1969. So the backstory is that I grew up in a small Midwestern a town called Appleton, Wisconsin. Just to put it on the map, Appleton is about 30 miles from Green Bay. So as we were growing up, and I'm saying this in the latter part of the 50s and into the 60s, and so when the Packers started to win and football became much more aware to a younger generation because of television, so we were Packer fans. I grew up in a bar. My father owned a bar. We lived right behind it. We ultimately moved upstairs, so it was a two-story building. And so we were one block from downtown. And so it was a neighborhood kind of a deal. You grew up with the school, the Catholic school in which we went to was a block away. And so your friends were all in the neighborhood, as they say. And so, you know, you look back on it, it was a maybe somewhat of an idyllic time. You played organized sports because you organized it. There weren't any little leagues or Babe Ruth leagues or there were rec leagues by the recreation department. And or otherwise, you would pick up your teams within the neighborhood. And then we started playing the latter part of junior high school, let's say, in an organized fashion at the Catholic grade school at that time. Then, so it was the baby boomer move. And just to put things in perspective at that time was that there was a growth that was taking place of us younger kids that were coming in. And so we had a brand new high school that was built called the Xavier High School, a new Catholic high school that was in the area. And so a lot of kids from around the area that had gone to Catholic grade schools then morphed into this brand new high school. And we had much success during that period of time. And so we had won our championship, and ultimately we were the number one ranked team in both football and in basketball during that period of time. And because of that success, I get an opportunity to continue my education, and I get to go to the University of Notre Dame. And there was a big change that took place at that level as well. And so that change was coaching change. Eric Parsegian came in as my freshman year, and all of a sudden he turns the program around. And by my junior year, we win a national championship. And I get to be captain of the football team my senior year. And during that period of time, I only lost 5 games. And so success was mounting one another. And because of that, I get to be drafted in the NFL by the Pittsburgh Steelers. And as I tell people, just to put in perspective, I was not their first choice, nor their top 10 list. I was the 417th person picked in the draft. I was the 16th round draft choice at that time, but I got a chance to be able to make the team, and ultimately the rest of the story goes on. So in high school, or at least in 1963, there was this conflict that was taking place over in the Far East in Vietnam. And it's, you know, started to make the news, and we had gone over to help the French in that conflict because of a treaty that we had. So all of a sudden, you know, but you're, so high school was taking place. There was military action taking place. So it became part of the news. Then we go on to college, we get a deferment, and then things start to escalate. So through that period of time, from 64 to 68, my years in college, is that it was the somewhat center of attention. It was always in the news as it expanded and grew. And you were part of that population that possibly could be drafted. So now all of a sudden, high school friends that had dropped out of school or didn't know what they were going to do, enlisted and or got drafted. And the draft was a big issue. Then the war started to escalate, and because it escalated, it became an unpopular conflict over there. Now, the soldier at that time was then identified with the conflict and not necessarily being praised as he is today. So it was just there. It was just always a part of your life. So when you talk about the military, yeah, it was kind of just friends were enlisted into different branches and or got drafted and were in Vietnam and served or came back. And so it was a part of your awareness factor that this conflict was going on. So it was always around you. You know, I had friends that had dropped out of college and got drafted and weren't necessarily, they had gone to Vietnam, but weren't necessarily in a combat unit. They were in support mechanisms or part of the service, but they were still there. So then the student movement started to take hold, and that was college students getting involved in anti-war demonstrations and et cetera, et cetera. Most of the feedback that I had received, and to some degree, was nobody was anybody who was in the military, I should say, was not really opposed to what was taking place. It was just a part of where they were at that time, you know, that they were in the military, that they were serving. And so, I mean, at least that's the feedback that I received from those that I had talked to. I got drafted, as I had made mention, by the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I was their 16th round draft choice. And so you're in training camp and you're going through not knowing what was taking place, just trying to do your best and so on. And it was the latter part of the training camp, as I say, the happiest day of my life at that moment in time, which was the head coach, after a meeting that I was in, Bill Austin was his name, And he had, I was walking out of the meeting and he said, can I talk to you for a moment? And so I said, oh, okay, fine. And so he pulled me aside and he said, listen, we got this letter in the mail. It was opened accidentally. It was to me, but it was opened accidentally. And he said, we think you're good enough to make this team and we will take care of this for you. Well, the letter was my 1A classification, which just meant I lost my student deferment and I was now eligible for the draft. Whatever take care of this meant in his mind, it was like, I'm good enough to make the team. So time goes by, a week goes by, 2 weeks go by, a month goes by. I hadn't heard anything kind of from the Steelers and we're just kind of doing our process. And so unlike today, maybe, but I go down to the Steeler office and talk to the general manager and I go, hey, have you guys heard anything about this taking care of this for me? And he said, we're having a little problem. General retired. The congressman got defeated. All our contacts are, you know, but we're working on it, whatever that meant as well. So in my mind, which was that, and the only experience I had was through the Green Bay Packers. And so when I would be back home prior to going to training camp, there would always be an article in the paper about those players that were in the reserve. And so they would go to 2 weeks during the summer. Or they'd be on weekend calls, as the regulation was at that time. So they're just little stories. And, you know, in the back of my mind, it goes, well, that's the possibility of what may happen if you make the team. So anyway, as time goes on, all of a sudden I slip, you know, through the cracks. And it was after the 10th game of the season, and I was down at training camp. We were at the stadium and I was sitting on my stool, much like this, getting ready to go out to practice. When one of the equipment men hollered, hey, Blair, there's a letter over here for you. Now, you have to understand, in the locker room, not any different than any other locker rooms, is that there was a table, and usually on that table was where all the fan mail would be deposited for the players. When you're not on a winning team, there's not a whole lot of fan mail. And when you're the 416th pick of the NFL draft and nobody knows you exist playing on a losing team, there's not a whole lot of fan mail. And so, you know, I was surprised that there was a letter and I walked over there and I picked it up, opened it up, slipped out the paper inside, unfolded it and said, greetings, we'd like to inform you that you've been inducted into the armed services of your country. Kind of came out of left field, let's say. And I knew it was hanging out there because I hadn't heard anything from the Steelers and it's a possibility and things were getting kind of tight. But the kicker was to report the next morning at 7 a.m. to be inducted into the armed services. Now, I thought they're supposed to give you a week, aren't they, at least? Well, it was post-dated a week before, got lost in the mail. By the time I received it, it was to report the next day. So there was kind of a panic at that time to say, all right, fine, holy man. And so eventually, I did report the next morning. They gave me 24 hours to get my stuff together. And so it really wasn't until the following morning when I was inducted. Now, part of that was, you know, as I look back on it now, maybe part of the helpful thing was the reaction, you know, of having to be in a mode to deal with it immediately, meaning my life. Okay, I got to call my parents. I got to get this together. I got to get that together. Talk to the Steelers, knowing that the following day I was going to be gone. So I packed my bag, did everything they had to do, and went to basic training and then went to AIT and ultimately got my orders. Part of it wasn't you had to sit around, you know, thinking about, oh, what if this and, you know, so on. So you're in that reactive mode of just dealing with the issues at that time and moving forward. And so that was it. I didn't have time to question or wonder why. And so I am now a buck private in in the armed forces. 1968 was the height of the war in Vietnam. We had the most personnel that was over there. It was over 500,000 troops in Vietnam. So the escalation was to get more troops over there. So it came down and, you know, so my MOS was, you know, 11 Bravo. Like everybody in our group was 11 Bravo. And so that was it, you know, so it was like your fate. I got my orders. So I flew home, said goodbye. I had a couple weeks after AIT to report to in San Francisco fly over to Vietnam. I joined the unit, but so we flew over. So yes, so it was the airline was packed with young soldiers, and you know everybody had a seat. Your duffel bag was between your legs, and you just sat there until you landed in Vietnam. So we landed. And I didn't know what to expect. You know, you landed and I didn't know there was fighting or what to expect at the airfield, you know, whether it was shooting back and forth and so on. And so we deplaned, grabbed our bags, got into a bus. The bus was taking us to registration, wherever that was at the time. So there were bars on the windows of the bus. And I was thinking, wow, what's happening here? What was taking place? You know, was there fighting on the way down? You know, was there shooting? None of that I knew. And you know, so somebody explained the fact that there were bars on it so that nothing could break or come through the windows as we were walking through. But that was my first experience. And so we got into where we needed to report, got to our bunks and dropped our stuff off and went through the process. So when I got my assignment of where I was going to go, finally a helicopter picks us up and drops us off at the LZ. And I was attached to I was with the AmeriCal Division, the 196th Brigade, 4th of the 31st Infantry. I was in Charlie Company. And I reported to Charlie Company. So I got to Charlie Company and so we were on LZ West, one of the landing zones, and there was nobody there except for the artillery guys. All our guys were down on a sweep off the LZ. And so I was hanging around until they came back up. And I remember my first impression was they just all were haggard and they were tired and they were climbing up the side of the mountain to come back after their sweep. And the image in my mind was like every military picture I saw, every World War II picture I saw of these guys. Some, you know, had that 1,000-yard stare, just trying to exist. Coming in, and I'm going, ooh, wow. I mean, that opened my eyes. And so I was the first new guy to come in 3 months to be attached to that unit. And so saw the first sergeant. He came in. He put me with first squad. And they said, okay, fine. And you're going to be a grenadier. 2 days later, he said, okay, fine. This is what you're going to be. You're going to carry the grenade launcher. We're going to put you on the M60, but we don't need anybody over there. We need somebody to be a grenadier. So this is what your responsibility is. And so that was my first reaction at that time. And so then part of that was, as I'd said, we were up there for a period of time, you know, in the squad I was in, and we'd be taking sweeps off of the mountain and coming back up, and you just kind of got into the mode of just being there. You know, it was kind of interesting, and you know, it is that you know, ultimately, the comparison is that it wasn't any different than any training camp I'd gone through from an experience point of view. And I say this to some degree, whether it be in college, basically, and or in my 1 year with the Steelers in training camp. But training camp is, you know, training camp. And so you're trying to survive. You're trying to make a team. You're trying to do, what is expected of you. You know, you got assignments. And so you kind of focus on that aspect of it. You might be tired. You have to run sprints. You got to do the conditioning, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's somewhat much like the military. Now, all of a sudden, you're focused in what you had to, you know, what you had to do. So there's a couple things as you're working through this, is that how other people respond to the situation and or leadership. Now, I'm 23 years old. So I think my lieutenant's 24 years old. The other guys around me are maybe 18, 19, 20, 21. And so all we're doing is we're trying to survive and do our responsibility, whatever that may be. And you go through this process, going down on sweeps, coming back up on sweeps, you know, you're tired. And ultimately, whether this would be part of this answer, but ultimately you have to find a reason. You have to find a reason why you're there. You have to find a reason why you may be shot and or die for something outside of defending our own land or being in our own home or whatever it might be. So now all of a sudden you're over there. And I don't know whether a lot of soldiers found that reason. And whether or not it was the right reason, but you have to come up with why are you here, and what are you willing to fight for or get out of this? And so I guess mine was that in some of those sweeps coming off the hills down in the villages, there were hooches, little villages, there were just mamasans and babies, and older people. And so the way, you know, I can remember coming through a small little encampment and they were, boiling a hoof, like a steer hoof, in a bucket of water. And that was their meal. And so you just thought, well, okay, fine. You know, if my presence here can help them maybe take one step forward rather than two steps backward, maybe that is well worth us being here. Simple as it may be and not in depth, but I think that it becomes important for each soldier to be able to find a reason outside of defending their country or for their country, a personal reason why they are there, and that they may lose their lives over. Not that that'll ever happen, but deep down inside, I think that somebody thinks about that. And so I, as simple as that may be, that became part of the reason, or at least for me, an acceptance of being there.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Your battalion, made up of four companies, had an area of operation in which they covered. So in that area, we operated from two landing zones, LZ West, as I had made mention, and LZ Siberia. The landing zones were on top of hilltops or mountains, and that's where the heavy artillery was located. And so that's where supplies would come in for the troops also up there. So you would rotate. A company each would be security around those landing zones up on top, and two would be down in the field doing maneuvers and searching and trying to follow or find the enemy. So then they would rotate. So you'd be down in the field, then up on an LZ, then down in the field, up an LZ, usually maybe 10 days to maybe 2 weeks deployment of that kind of a nature. So as you come to learn is that in your on the sweeps, so when you're on an LZ, then every day you would take a platoon or a squad would go down, take a sweep down into an area of operation around that base, and then walk back up in the evening. And so then that would rotate while you're up there day after day after day after day after day. So you weren't doing it every day, but that was it. Now, one of the things about it is that when you're on the LZ, you're in a stationary position. So the Viet Cong knew where you were. So they knew those coordinates. And so every day, just about every day, there was always some action that would take place. So every now and then, as you're up there pulling security guard, someone would have a rocket grenade launcher. And then all of a sudden, you'd hear an explosion. So the sound would be incoming. Okay, everybody know, and they would then walk the rockets up or the grenades up the side of the hill. And so it would hit one, explode, hit another. And then we'd return fire once we finally found where that location was. But that would happen sporadic while you were up on the mountain. In the valley, when you're walking, now you're moving. So you're moving and the enemy's moving. And unlike today, because of the technology we have, you weren't as viable on the field or on the ground doing those sweeps out in the field. And because, you know, if you happen to run across one another, you might. So we'd come into villages and we'd check out the villages and so on, and then move on, and we'd have an area of operation. So your day would be, you get up, you get a cup of coffee, you'd make it, you know, then you'd move out. You get to a point where you'd have stop for, quote, lunch, so to speak. And then you'd move out of that area after a couple hours into another area where you'd have a bivouac for that evening. You set up a security guard, and you would do that and repeat that day after day after day as you move through that area of operation. So it was different places and different expectation. But at every place, you know, you had to pull guard duty within your platoon and or within your area. So you'd switch, you know, you'd be up for 2 hours, and then your teammate would be up for 2 hours, and then you have a third guy. And so you get like 4 hours sleep if you could. And then you just rotate through the evening until we got up in the morning and moved out to the next location. So the details of that day was that we're up on an LZ Siberia, our company is, and all of a sudden, let's just say it was over the weekend, all of a sudden we get a report that there's enemy activities. Just, you know, I'm a grunt, I'm a private. So all you do is get what's fed down to you. You don't know what's happening or why it's happening or whatever it is. So all of a sudden we're on 24-hour alert. Now 24-hour alert is, whoa, there's some stuff happening out here. That means nobody's on break. Everybody's alert. We're on 24 hours as best we possibly can to manage that. We may be moving out. So finally, as bits of information get down to where we are, and ultimately this story I didn't find out all this until after the fact, but there was a movement by the NVA out of North Vietnam they had a whole regiment that was moving down into the Hep Duc Valley. That's where we were located, up in I Corps. And so this movement was moving down of regimental soldiers. So a Bravo company was out in the field. Charlie Company, was on LZ Siberia. We're on 24-hour alert. They got hit or were under attack. And all of a sudden, we are helicoptered or pulled together to get out. And helicopter, we're flying down into the valley. And our mission is to get to Bravo Company to give them the support they needed or whatever. So we're flying out in helicopters, get out, assemble. We're moving out through the late afternoon into the early evening. There's a firefight taking place. Helicopters are coming in. I can see a machine gun from the enemy. One of the helicopters got hit. So all this action, but it was taking place at night. Our mission was there to get and support Bravo Company. So by the time we get to them, it is late at night. And what bodies that did not get removed by helicopters, we were now going to move them out of that spot. So our responsibility was to pull front and rear security and carry what dead that were left and out of that area. So we're trying to move that whole, what was left of Bravo Company. So all of a sudden, there was a body that was left. I grabbed another guy, said, come on, we got to take him out of here. I threw my grenade launcher to one of my friends behind us. And so we picked the body up. And as we're moving out, we had to cross a stream. And so there was a machine gun position on the stream. Now, all of a sudden, it opens fire and we're in another firefight very quickly. After a period of time, the word was to... let's leave the bodies. Let's move out as, you know, best we possibly can. So eventually we did move out and we hook up with another company that was in the field. We set up a defensive position that night. Next morning, we're moving back. So our company was going to go back to retrieve the bodies that had been left behind. And so it was a reinforced platoon. As we were moving forward, and the reinforced platoon was basically the command central. So our company commander was with us and a couple lieutenants and the radio guy and the rest of our platoon. So we had gone back and we were walking on an open rice paddy. So we're coming onto this wooded area onto an open rice paddy when all of a sudden our point man saw movement across the berm. And shots broke the stillness and the enemy started to run and he started to chase and pulling everybody out in the middle of that rice paddy when all of a sudden a machine gun starts to level the area. Bodies were diving left and right into the rice paddies that we were crossing. And so I jumped in one in front of me, got to the end of it, looked down, four other guys were pinned down in an open rice paddy. as well. I did see the machine gun, or I could see where it was coming from. It was maybe 150 meters away up on the hillside. So as a grenadier, my responsibility is to get some firepower onto that position. So I rolled over my side, breached my grenade, and went to fire when I felt a thud in my left leg. And it started burn, and it bled. At the same time, the soldier behind me had hollered at me, "Rock," to get my attention. And I thought that he threw a stone at me that hit me in the thigh, and I was until it continued to hurt and hurt and hurt. And so I was hit for the first time that day. I discharged my round. Now I thought, okay, they hit you once, they're going to hit you again. So I moved behind some hedgerow that was to the left of me, get a little more protection. So I got enough firepower on that machine gun position so that the four guys who were pinned down in front of me got out of there and moved back. And eventually we had moved out of that rice paddy and back into the wooded area in which we had just came out of. And we set up another defensive position, and they probed our perimeter basically over a period of time. They probed our perimeter, got close enough. When out of the corner of my eye, I saw a grenade come flying through the air, end over end over end over end over end, and it hit my commanding officer right in the middle of the back. He was lying prone, looking out over the field of fire, and boom, it hits him in the back, bounces off, rolls between my feet. As I get up to jump out of the way, it blows up between my feet and my legs. And we're in another firefight until a sister platoon finally fought its way down to get us out of there. They came down. There was a lull. So then they carried us out of there. So I can remember lying there. This reinforced platoon, as I said, came and... the first guy that dove into where I was, he says, "Oh, you're all right. Yeah. Oh, we got a report that you bought it. That you and the lieutenant had got killed. I'm glad you didn't. Boy, we'll get you out of here." Said, "Don't worry. You'll be the first guy that I'll get you out of here." I said, "Okay, fine." Then he comes back to me. He said, "No, I'm sorry. The lieutenant's going to be the first guy. You're going to be the second guy." I said, "Oh, okay, fine." So they dragged me out of there on a poncho liner. And so four guys carried each corner, and started carrying me through the evening. Now, we had a distance to go. There were, I think, about a click or a couple clicks away to where the landing zone was that we had secured earlier, or that another company had secured. And that's where we're heading through the night. So they pulled me and pulled me and pulled me and pulled me through the night. Now, they'd been up just as long as we had. They'd been in a firefight as well, coming down to get us out of there. So they were tired, and it finally got to a point where they said, "Hey, we can't drag you any further. Don't worry, we'll send a stretcher back for you." And I said, "Okay, fine." And then an amazing story had taken place at that time, or an action. And you don't think about it until afterwards, when all of a sudden a fellow soldier reaches down and picks me up and throws me over his shoulder and starts carrying me to the helicopter. And the helicopter was still a far way away. And so he would put me down, my blood all over him, and he'd catch his breath and pick me up again and continue on until he got me onto that chopper. And I never saw him again and didn't know who he was or where he came from, where he lived, or anything. But the interesting thing was that he was a soldier of color. Now, it may not mean much now in that society, but, at that time, back in the 60s, I mean, a lot of things were going on from a social basis. I mean, there was segregation still going on in colleges that would not let Black students be there or sign up. And so now all of a sudden, here it is, I have a Black soldier picking me up, not because he's Black and I'm white, but it was like, brother to brother. And, you know, it was the immediacy of the time, and you don't think about race, you don't think about anything. And I think that's one of the great things about the military. It just levels the playing field for human beings to react with one another and as a fellow soldier. And so that was like we became, you know, we became brothers in that brotherhood of war. So it was an interesting experience. You know, people say, well, why, you know, did you do it? I think the inner drive for me was to be able to come back and play football. I mean, because I wanted to, it was part of my identity or whatever it meant, but it became a driving force. Also, there were some lessons learned, I think, from my point of view, as human nature. As I tell people, I said, you know, one of the things playing sports specifically, or not even playing sports, but just playing in the neighborhood, is that we all have bumps and bruises as we grow up. You know, you get scraped knees, you might sprain your ankle, twist your knee, you know, God forbid that you break a finger or whatever it is, you know, then you'd be in a cast. But there's a process that you learn, and that process is that you get hurt. It hurts. You go see mom. She takes you to a doctor. Doctor says, this is what we do. You know, then you rehab, it heals, and you're back out playing within a week or 2 weeks thereafter. And so it's that kind of a mindset. So my mindset was that, okay, I'm injured. I didn't lose an arm. I didn't lose leg, damaged as it may be, but I've been there before. So you just go through the process. And I think one of the things in that process is getting back, having an opportunity, getting back to work, getting back your body back in shape as you best possibly can, not knowing what the future may be. The other thing is that I wanted to get to a point where I would erase those ifs that we carry around with us. If I would have done this, if I would have done that, if I would have worked out more, et cetera, it might have worked out. And so I went back trying to get my body back in shape as I was still in the military, and went through that process. And I came back to the Steelers in 1970. I got out of the service and I went back to training camp in 1970. I had to write Mr. Rooney to see whether I could be invited. And he said, yes, you know, come on back. And so the interesting thing is that I was there for the whole period of time. Being the family that they were, they gave me an opportunity. And basically that was it. I went as best I possibly could. I thought I was in pretty good shape, but 2-a-days takes its toll. And ultimately, they put me on injured reserve. I have another operation. They buy me a year. Come back the following year, and I go through training camp again, a little bit better this time, and I make the taxi squad, or the developmental squad, as they say now. So they bought me 2 years, 2 years to heal, 2 years to get bigger, stronger, faster, to come back, or whatever it is. And so I come back in now in 1972. And I come back in 1972, I'm the leading ground gainer during the exhibition season in 1972. And good enough to make the team, played special teams, never carried the ball the remaining part of that season. Came back in 73. A little bit bigger, a little bit stronger. And so in 1973, it was the biggest that I had been. I weighed 218 pounds coming back in the training camp. I bench pressed 465 pounds. I squatted over 600 pounds. And again, I was the leading ground gainer during the exhibition season. Got to carry the ball once during that season. But in our lives, what we decide or how we look at things is that, you know, to come back the following year, again, to come back in 1974, I would have to fight with every free agent, draft choice, and rookie to do so. And I just didn't think it was fair, not that life's fair, but I thought maybe it's a sign. Maybe my life's going in another direction. We do this at times. You know, I did come back. I did make the team. I got a chance to play. Maybe not to the level I thought, but hey, that wasn't part of the deal. And after the 73 season, I left the Steelers to find my life's work, not to come back. And as that story goes, I get a call from Andy Russell, who was our captain of the time, as the all-pro linebacker. He was coming in Chicago. That's where I was living. And he said, let's get together. There's a sports banquet taking place, sponsored by the NFL. Guys are coming from all over leagues. I mean, when you come, I hadn't seen you. It'd be great to get together. So I'm not going back in my mind. I declined. He pushed, I declined. And then he asked me why. And I said, well, I quit. I'm not going back. And I remember him saying, you can't quit. He said, if you quit, what you've already done is you've already made a decision for that coaching staff. Do you like them well enough to make decisions for them? He said, no. Your responsibility, if this is what you want to do, is that you make them make a decision. You back them in the corner. You give them every reason to either keep you or release you, but you don't cut yourself. The reality of this game is that we're all expendable. The reality of this game is we all can be cut at any time. But if this is what you want, then you don't cut yourself. Maybe it was just the arm twisting I needed, and I went back. And everything that I had perceived did take place. And I had a fight with every free agent, draft choice, and rookie once again to make the team. And I made the team, a leading ground gainer during the exhibition season. Now, I say that just to put it in context. The reason I was a leading ground gainer wasn't because of the fact I was bigger, better, faster than all the other running backs. No, it was a simple fact that during that exhibition season, I played more than anybody else. I carried the ball more than anybody else because they're trying to make a decision on me. And given those two simple facts, I better be the leading ground gainer because all they were providing for me was an opportunity. And I made the team. I was the fifth running back out of four at the beginning of the season. But things happen, as we well know, in our lives, and especially in sports. An injury here, an injury there, and all of a sudden I find myself getting a chance to play. Then I find myself in a starting role. And the rest becomes history. And we go to the Super Bowl for the first time that year, 74. And we play six more years, Franco and I and Bradshaw on that backfield, and we win three more Super Bowls. And so you become part of that, the starting team, because of an opportunity that somebody pushed you through the door, somebody gave you a chance to be able to do it, and you have to take advantage of it.
That was specialist Rocky Blyer. In honor of Veterans Day, Blyer and I ask that you consider donating to help veterans in need. The National Veterans Foundation provides assistance to veterans with needs including medical treatment, PTSD counseling, VA benefits advocacy, food, shelter, employment, training, legal aid, suicide intervention, and more. Visit nvf.org to learn how you can help. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcast.com. We're always looking to improve the show. For updates and more, follow us on Twitter at @team_Harbaugh. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with The Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhl-Hoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloya, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.